right now or getting ready Lock to set up Talk
Radio. Cause like a winter tonight.
Everyone, this is the Ask Dr. Carlo show. So, thank you for coming back to our third show of the week. Today, we're actually going to do something a little different. I do another show called Mental Health Insights and Psychology Tidbits, and I have a few of those excerpts from those programs that you will get to listen to if we don't have any callers or we have extra time instead of me filling it in with some lectures, because I think those presentations are really good. One of the presentations we did on Mental Health Insights is actually on anger. I'm not going to show the whole thing or have you listen to the whole thing because it would take up most of the time of the show, but I will do part of it. The other one is a psychology tidbit on crying. We'll get a little bit of insight of why do we cry. So we'll let you listen to some of those in a bit. But before we do that, I do want to talk a little bit about anxiety, especially in the world of performance. Yesterday, I was on a show with Mo and Mel, the podcast, where we talked about anxiety performance. We talked about a host of mental health issues. But this was one that I thought might be appropriate to talk about. See, athletes are more prone to feeling the effects of anxiety on performance than the general public. Unless, of course, you're an actor or something where you have to be on the spot and you have to perform in a certain way. So what we found out was the following. Amateur athletes are more likely than seasoned professionals to experience anxiety that interferes with their ability to perform in competition. This makes sense due to the relative lack of experience both in competition and in managing their emotions. You see, the more seasoned you are, the more you've experienced different things, the more you're able to manage and understand what's happening to you. These are really crucial tidbits for somebody who's just starting a sport or somebody who's not a professional who hasn't been doing it for very long. Make sure you realize every little downside, every kind of challenge or failure that you incur, pay attention to it. Because these are things you're going to be learning in the future how to handle. Find out how you handled it. Find out how other athletes handle it. Find out what are some of the major challenges other athletes face in your sport so you're prepared for it when it does happen. Athletes who participate in individual sports have also been found to experience more anxiety than those who play team sports. This probably makes common sense to most people. It suggests that being part of a team alleviates some of the pressure experienced by those that compete alone. And that makes perfect sense. Trying to distribute the responsibility a little bit can lighten the load. There's also evidence that in team sports, when a team plays at the venue of the opposition, or sometimes called away games, anxiety levels tend to be higher than when playing at home. This is probably another no-brainer. Common sense would indicate that having greater fan support and more familiarity with the venue plays a role in anxiety levels during competition. And this actually happens to us as well many times. When we're going into an environment we're not sure of, people we don't know, our anxiety level will go up. So, nothing there, nothing surprising there. So let's go ahead and take a look. We're going to let you listen to a little bit of an excerpt, about 2.5 minutes, on crying. If you want to call in, our number is 646-929-0749. This is the Ask Dr. Carlo show. We believe in empowering people to grow and build change in their lives in the shortest amount of time possible. So here you go. Listen to the tidbits.
Welcome to Ask Dr. Carlos Psychology Tidbits. We've changed our name. I know it's getting kind of confusing, but we're kind of aggressive over here. And now we are the Ask Dr. Carlos Psychology Tidbit program. Today we're going to be looking at crying. Why does one person choke up over a Hallmark commercial while another sheds tears only for the death of a loved one? Does the exhortation "have a good cry" carry physiological or psychological benefits? Well, new research by psychologists are beginning to answer these questions, helping us better understand what human tears mean. According to Professor Vingerhorst, psychology professor at Tilburg University in the Netherlands, he says, quote, "I think the study of crying more than is the case for any other emotional expression may help us to obtain a better insight into human nature." Several factors play a role in an individual's propensity to cry. Gender differences in crying, for example, have been explored for decades. A study found in the 1980s that women cry an average of 5.3 times a month, while men cry an average of 1.3 times a month. That even seems high for me. Biologically, there may be a reason women cry more than men. Testosterone may inhibit crying. The hormone prolactin, seen in higher levels in women, may promote it. But a desire to cry is not all nature. A study of people in 35 countries found that the difference between how often men and women cry may be more pronounced in countries that actually allow greater freedom of expression and social resources, such as Sweden and the United States. But countries like Ghana, Nigeria, on the other hand, reported only slightly higher tear rates for women. Another study done by author Diane Van Hermit, a senior researcher at the Netherlands organization, said that people in wealthier countries may cry more because they live in a culture that permits it, while people in poorer countries, who presumably might have more to cry about, don't do so because of cultural norms that frown on emotional expression. There you go. It's a psychology tidbit. If you want to learn more about human behavior, you can go to watch our web video show on therapycable.com and look for us there at Circle of Insight. You can also now catch our call-in talk show on Mondays at 12 p.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern time on Blog Talk Radio.
Well, there you go, everyone. Hopefully you enjoyed that. That's a little bit of a tidbit, like I was saying, from our show, Psychology Tidbits. Let's talk a little bit more about what's really going on. So we're going to talk today about making choices in our lives. How do we make choices in our lives? What are those things that are happening in our unconscious that really do influence us? You see, when you have a decision-making model that I created a while back ago, it kind of guided me on how we make choices. So let me explain. First thing we do is we see something externally in the environment, a person, an event, whatever it may be, we call that an external stimuli, right? Something has stimulated us, has approached our senses, whether it be our eyes or ears or nose or mouth. One of the senses has been activated by the stimuli. So we're going to say we saw somebody. What happens then, the information goes through your retina, in your pupil, through your retina, to your optic nerve, all the way into, starts heading into your brain. From the optic nerve, it starts shooting into the brain, and that starts hitting areas I call areas of vulnerability. These areas of vulnerability is an area where unconscious factors start, how would you say, distorting the information we're receiving. Our areas of vulnerability are comprised of our past associations, past relationships, past experiences, as well as evolutionary adaptations. Evolutionary adaptations being the fight or flight that you commonly heard, food or sex, these four basic needs of man to survive and to live. So these areas of vulnerability start distorting a little bit the image that we get from the external environment. So if we see somebody, if that person reminds us of someone from our past, that's going to have an impact as it progresses through our decision-making model. So let's start again. First thing, external stimuli comes from the environment. It heads in through your eyes, and it starts hitting your brain, and then it goes to the areas of vulnerability, and your past experiences are going to start coloring this picture of what you see. So let's say you had a bad experience with this type of person. You see them coming across the street, whatever it may be. Now it starts coloring a little bit of your perception. Now these areas of vulnerabilities over time create our attitudes, our beliefs, and our values, right? So if you believe something about that type of person, that can start changing how you perceive it. And then another scenario, another step up, I guess you could say better, another step is then it becomes the decision-making process. And just before that, you're actually going to get into the perception process. But before you get to the perception process, there's something called cognitive heuristics, basically mental shortcuts, because we can't deliberate over everything we see. So what happens is we have these little shortcuts that are created by our past experiences and associations and relationships. So if we see this person and remind us of the past, these shortcuts will say this person was A, B, C, 1, 2, 3, whatever category you want to use. You'll start getting this criteria, you'll generalize, and then from there it goes to your perception. This is the type of person it is. It goes into your decision-making process. This type of person, now I need to walk away, I need to hide, whatever it may be, I need to protect myself, and then the final one is you act on it. So once again, start this process over. You receive external stimuli. You see somebody walking down the street. It goes into your optic nerve, into your brain. The areas of vulnerability, your past associations, relationships, experiences start distorting the picture or clarifying the picture. It's not always negative. Once it starts doing that, then you're going to get an idea, right? Then from there, it goes into your values, your attitudes, and your beliefs. And then it goes into your cognitive heuristic if you don't have very much time. Now, if you have a lot of time because you have quite a bit of distance, you can deliberate. You can start saying, well, is this person this type of person? Was the situation the same? Was it a different neighborhood? But if you don't, you'll go to cognitive heuristic, the mental shortcut, and you're going to go off of your past experiences and associations, and you're probably even going to access your evolutionary adaptation of fight or flight. So if you feel threatened by this person, you're either going to run away or you're going to stand up and fight if there is such an altercation. Then it goes straight into your decision-making process, right? Or just before that, actually, your perception of this person, and then it goes into your decision-making and then your action. And this, believe it or not, a lot simpler to see than it is to say over the radio, but it happens every time we make a choice. In very fast time, though, very speedy. And this is not, drone on like I just did here for a few minutes. This happens in seconds, milliseconds in your brain. So a lot of things will trigger things in our brain, in our mind. Past experiences were triggered by a phrase, by a word, by a smell, by an action. And these things will start influencing our values, our beliefs, our attitudes, influencing how we perceive life, influencing how we make decisions and take actions. So a lot of times our decisions are really based on what we thought happened in the past. You see, for instance, if I asked you, what are you experiencing right now? By the time you answer that, it isn't right now anymore. It's what you were experiencing. And it really becomes more of an idea of what you were experiencing, a theory, a concept. The minute it gets into your brain and time starts passing, it starts getting distorted. Our memories are not like Polaroid pictures or camera pictures. They don't always look the same. Every time we recall a memory, you're going to put those pieces together. And you may not always put all the pieces either in the right spot, or you may not have all the pieces, or you may add pieces to that memory. So this time distortion can really cause a problem. So these past experiences, these past associations, sometimes can really hinder our ability to make a judgment, to make a decision. Now, I'm not saying they're all bad. There's a lot of times they're there to help us. And they can guide us to make the right choices. But we have to deliberate. The moral of the story is to really understand how we make decisions and what's influencing us. We have to comprehend, especially the important decisions in our lives, was anything happening in the past that's influencing my decision today? The mate I've chosen, the girlfriend I've chosen, the life I've chosen, the alcohol, my anger, my anxiety. Is anything in the past triggering these events? Once you've identified that, you can start the healing process and start working on yourself. Because you can start figuring it out from the algorithm, right? 7 little steps to making an action, and the 6 steps to make a decision. And once you start spotting where the area of vulnerability was, which is in your unconscious, and you start figuring out what it was in the past, you've identified it and defined it, then you can take care of it in the present. We're going to go ahead and take a break. We're waiting for your calls. We do have an email we're going to answer right after these messages.
Cause like a wind chime tonight.
Welcome back, everyone. I still want you guys to listen to the anger episode that we did, but we're going to have to wait for that. It still hasn't completed on download. Hopefully, it'll do it before the end of the show. So we were talking earlier about the decision-making algorithm or model, the steps and how we make decisions and take actions, and how important it really is to learn about the area of vulnerabilities, right? When we choose our mates, when we choose our careers, when we choose how to act, a lot of times that's coming from the area of vulnerability, our unconscious mind, our past experiences, past relationships, past associations. How many times have you broken up with somebody and all you remember are the good things, right? Now that they're gone, you can't have them, all you remember are the good things. This is how our mind can trick us or protect us, depending on who you ask. We're trying to protect the loss. So we focus on all those good things, but at the same time, it causes a lot of pain because we do miss it. But that's the game of the memory. That's why I was saying, how we recall certain things, or most things, really may not be as accurate as we think. So we have to be careful, especially when we make judgment calls or decisions, because a lot of them are based on this. They're based on our memories. And our memories are not always very accurate. Here's another interesting fact. Our memory actually gets even more distorted or can be influenced by your mood in the current day. For instance, if you're in a bad mood and you remember a certain event, or you had to remember a certain event, it may not be the same memory as if the next day you remembered it in a good mood. That's right. Your moods on the day you recall a memory can influence how you remember. Isn't that amazing? I know, it probably leaves you thinking, well, what do I remember? How do I know if I ever make a right decision? Well, we do. Many times we gather other data as well. People who make wise decisions usually gather as much data as they can when it's an important decision. Athletes or businessmen or psychologists, whatever your profession is, if you've done it over and over and over again, you become really good. You've seen a lot of different scenarios and variety of issues. That helps the memory. Because what happens is you can go on automatic when a situation comes up, and when you access those past emotions or those past memories, you're able to get a more accurate picture and a better understanding of what's going on. Bottom line, educating yourself and putting your beliefs on trial, as I always say, right? My acronym is TAP, Trial, Awareness, and Possibilities. If you put your limiting beliefs on trial or negative beliefs or thoughts that come in, then you'll have a better chance of making a good decision. So if you have limiting beliefs that say you're not worth anything or you're a loser or this or that, you want to put those guys on trial because those are going to distort the decision-making process. Think about this. Something's happening. You have to make a choice, right? Maybe to pick a partner or to move somewhere or to talk to somebody. In your area, this information starts going into your area of vulnerability, start accessing it, but now you have a limiting belief. That limiting belief translates into a certain perception. And that could affect how you make that decision. So you really want to put that limiting belief on trial, and you want to be able to go into a situation as neutral as possible. Because even having too much of a positive belief or expecting too many good things coming out of a certain situation can be a problem, because you might live in fantasy land. So it used to be said Pollyannish kind of attitude where it may distort your results. All right, folks, here's one of the questions we had the other day that I thought was kind of interesting. The question was from somebody who said they had an issue with their stepdad. Their stepdad was being way too demanding, and she didn't know how to handle the stepdad. She was 17. She is 17, so that was. She is 17 years old. She's trying to figure out how can I handle my stepdad. He's always demanding a lot of things from me. He wants me to be the super person, A's in school, do great in sports. This perfect human being. As we continue to investigate the issue, we found out that stepdad had lost a daughter in the past. And it seemed like he was trying to recapture that daughter through his stepdaughter. They do love each other, which is the good thing about it. But what I told her is that she needs to tell him. She needs to tell him that he is hurting her. One of the things we don't tend to do is we don't tell people that we're hurting at the time of the hurt or of the injury. We tend to delay it. And you know what happens when you delay it? It starts building up. And then it starts manifesting itself in different ways in ourselves, in our bodies and in our mind, in ways of anxiety, depression, the psychosomatic issues such as ulcers and others. We have to be able to tell people immediately. And to reflect back on what I said earlier about memory, just imagine if somebody hurts you, like the situation, and she doesn't say anything for 4, 6, 8 months, how is her memory going to be about that scenario? It's going to start getting distorted. May not be as accurate. He might not even remember what he did or said. So it's really important for her to start, and for you, to start telling people when you get hurt immediately in a nice way. You can tell them, listen, I feel hurt because of this, this, and this. I feel hurt when people tell me to do this. I feel hurt, or I feel sad, or I feel anxious if I have too much pressure being placed on me. And you can tell, I try to stay away from you, or you caused this, or you said this, or you did that. Because all that does is antagonize the other person and it causes a problem. So what you're really looking to do is first mention your hurt, mention the feeling you're having so you can clarify it in your own mind. Second, attack the action, right? This makes me feel. And then third, I wish I could relax more. I wish be less pressure on me. Try to find a solution to offer them, a different alternative. Many, many times people don't realize when we're hurt. So a lot of times when you tell them, they'll be appreciative and understand it. And if they don't, then you just have to take that and let it go. You won't always get what you want from people. But if you can release the hurt and you've stood up for yourself, that's one of the most important things. Because then later on, you won't regret it. You said your piece. If that person doesn't agree or doesn't say anything, there's nothing you can do. You've already done the most you can, and you should be proud of that to release those emotions. We're going to go ahead and take a break here, listen to Rebecca Jade, and we'll come right back. 'Cause like a winter. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. We have a few minutes left. Hopefully we'll get some of your calls today. We did get one email. So back to expressing hurt. One of the key things about hurt and letting go of the past is you have to find that hurt. You have to identify it. Once you've identified the hurt, what you need to do then is define it. What kind of hurt was it? Was it anger? Was it guilt? Was it shame? Once you have defined it, at that point, now you're able to clarify and understand what happened, right? What you don't want to do is you don't want to relive that past. You don't want to think about it over and over again. All you need to do is identify when it happened and what happened, right? Who are the players involved? And why is it being triggered now? Have you ever felt something, maybe angry or anxious? You don't know what triggered it at all. It just popped up. A lot of times these are repressed emotions. For instance, anger. Many times anger is something that we believe is unjust that is done to us. If your wife or husband asks you to do something, maybe you believe it's unjust. Maybe you think it's not right. But you don't know why. You just got angry. Maybe it was a simple thing. Take out the trash when all day you've been doing something around the house and they hadn't noticed. Now you feel this slight against you. So why would you respond as being angry? Many times our repressed emotions come from our childhood. So who knows? This could have come from early on in your life. Maybe your parents got angry at you. One of your parents did when you didn't do something. Or they always told you to do something. You didn't care, respect your feelings. Maybe you were doing something you wanted to do. And they interrupted you. And they just demanded you to do something. Whatever it may be, you need to find out where it came from, if you can. A lot of times it takes a little bit of digging, and that's when you need a professional to help you out. And speaking of that, we are here to help you. You can find us on www.thecircleofinsight.com. On the website, we'll find all about us, as well as our contact information. The great thing about now is we also are doing phone and online sessions via Skype or telephone at a great rate. And to help people who can't get out of the house, don't want to, a lot of single moms or a lot of people that work from home are loving it. It's a great way to be able to get our sessions and help us to help them consult. Once again, we believe in empowering people to grow and build change in their lives in the shortest amount of time possible. That's what we want to do. We want to be able to help people quickly identify and define their past hurts and then find solutions to their present problems. And to live a more happy and free life. There's nothing like being emotional. We thank you all for being here again. I hope you enjoy this show, and I hope we'll get some call-ins. We will not be back July 6th. We're going to be back July 13th. So just to give you an idea, we're going to take a week off next week. We'll be back July 13th. We hope to have you all listen in. We'll talk to you soon, everyone. Remember, I'm wishing you all good mental health.
'Cause like a wind chime.